Welcome everybody to episode 24 of the Blue Skies Dronecast, the podcast by UAV Hub. This is a podcast for the UK drone industry, discussing everything from the UK regulations, new drones, and also speaking to you, the people within the drone industry. Presented this week by Tom Patterson and Matthew Hurst. So welcome along, everyone, to episode 24. You might have noticed that I didn't introduce Adam, as he's on holiday this week, like you mentioned previously. But I've got Matthew with me to back me up this week. So hi, Matthew. How are you doing?
Yeah, going well, Tom. I think I may have used this phrase before, but while the cat's away, the mouse will play. So back to our sort of favourite topic this week, which you're about to introduce. Looking forward to it. It's going to be a nice one.
That's it, exactly right, yeah. So obviously we love having Adam on the podcast. It does make it nice when we've got three of us. But while he's not here, we're going to discuss a few different subjects this week. And hopefully they're both very interesting. And one of them exists and the second one potentially doesn't exist. And I'll explain that in a bit more detail later on. So the first subject we're going to talk about then is Google's Wing delivery drone. Okay, so before we start talking about this, the best thing that you can do as listeners is to actually go away, obviously not while you're listening, but maybe later on once you've heard the podcast, and actually go and watch the video, because the video actually really makes everything come to light and helps the kind of explanation and what we'll talk about a bit easier to digest as well. So we'll put the link into the podcast description. It's quite a long video, but it is worth watching, especially if you're interested in sort of model aircraft and delivery drones, etc. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that before we sort of started our talk. But essentially, Google are doing something very similar to Amazon, but probably more so, because theirs is actually working at the moment and actually delivering and in kind of everyday use, I suppose, really. So what we're going to do is briefly talk about kind of how they kind of got it off the ground, I suppose, really. And then we'll start talking about the aircraft and sort of how it all fits together, I suppose, really. And like I said, we'll talk, me and Matthew, about this first subject together. So first of all, they obviously designed this type of drone delivery aircraft. And the same way as we were talking about a few podcasts ago, they decided to go the VTOL way, because again, I think it's really the only way of doing something on this scale, I think, really, isn't it, Matthew? I think it's more to do with the fact that it can take off without a runway, like we mentioned, but then it's got a very good sort of a distance capability, which is, you know, very important, really. So they started off with something called a tail launcher. So again, there is a specific drone that does this. I want to say the Wingtra, I think.
Yes. Yep,
is that right, Matthew?
Sure. Yep, that's one.
Yeah, that's it. And it basically looks like a conventional aircraft, essentially, with two or four motors, you know, on the wings. And instead of sort of taking off with it level, it takes off on its tail. So it sits a bit like a rocket, I suppose, really. So that means it can
it's
use...
a good description. Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it can take off vertically with its four rotors, and then it can transition into forward flight while still using the same four rotors. So quite an interesting idea. And that's what Google went with to start with, I think, really. But then I think as they got further down the road, they realised that there wasn't much redundancy in that system. It was effectively one aircraft, and if the control systems failed or it had a control surface problem, it's going to be crashing. So they obviously went back to the drawing board, and they actually went kind of, I would say, almost back in kind of design to what we mentioned again, was the half multi-rotor, half fixed wing type of aircraft. So Matthew, just quickly, what does that kind of mean? You know, how is that aircraft? What does that aircraft look like if people are trying to picture it in their minds at the moment?
Mm. Well, Tom, it's a very interesting looking aircraft, and when people watch the video and as we talk more about it, you'll get a better and better picture of it. But in effect, it's a very conventional looking aeroplane with a normal set of wings, a normal tail. It's not a so-called sort of flying wing type design that the tail this one was. But along the length of the fuselage, in fact, it's got twin booms, but along the length of the fuselage, it has multiple motors which function in the same sort of configuration as a multi-rotor. But if you listen to what they say about the development of the power system and the propulsion and control system, they've done some really, really good thinking, which has sort of revolutionized, in my mind, the sort of concept that they're using. Because previously, every other one I've ever seen is basically a four-rotor setup, much like a quadcopter, strapped to the back of a fixed-wing aircraft, in principle. That's basically what it is. But in this case, Tom will expand a little more on this, I'm sure, in a moment. They've added to the number of motors and so on to make to give much better sort of backup and safety in terms of failure and things going wrong.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so kind of to build upon what you just mentioned. So obviously, normally, yeah, a quadcopter can take off with four rotors, and that's brilliant. But as we know, if it loses one rotor, then obviously it's game over pretty much. So what Google have actually done is almost taken this to the nth degree and actually given the multi-rotor 12 propellers, which is way more than it needs. And there's two massive benefits of this design. The first one is obviously redundancy. So I think they said it could almost lose four propellers at once and actually still continue to take off and land.
I wouldn't have thought they'd all be on one corner, but yeah, I think up to four in terms of lift capability, I'm sure that's possible, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So it's got loads of redundancy, which is brilliant. And one of the other things they mentioned as well, which I didn't think of and thought, oh, this is amazing actually, is the fact that because they've got 12 motors and propellers, the propellers can be very tiny instead of quite big. And obviously when they're not being used, they then don't do this strange windmill effect. And if you think about that, if you had four giant propellers spinning around kind of in the wind, it's going to really give the aircraft some problems. So the fact they're so tiny means that they don't really do that. And if they do, it doesn't really affect how the aircraft is flying, which I thought, I hadn't thought of that. And that was great, wasn't it, Matthew?
That really is revolutionary. I mean, the windmilling effect that you're talking about has a massive effect on the aerodynamics of the sort of standard layout that we spoke about a moment ago. So just to clarify, these 12 motors are all in the vertical axis for doing the lifting action of the aircraft. And then there's more motors along its wings for the forward propulsion before people sort of start to get confused about the picture. I think that's a quite a big improvement in concept, because I think what a lot of other companies are trying to do is they're developing mechanical systems and using electromagnetism and so on to try to stop the propellers in the longitudinal axis, the vertically mounted propellers, to minimize the effects of that windmilling and so on. But it's not an efficient thing to do. It's consuming energy, it's tricky, the mechanics can fail. It's just, there's a lot wrong with it, where these guys have simplified it simply by putting a row of motors with tiny props that have very little effect whether they run or not. So it's incredible. It's really thinking out of the box.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so it's very cool. Again, have a look at the picture, because it is kind of hard to describe. But another thing is the fact that they're using very small motors means that they're pretty much using motors that are made for FPV drones now. They're that tiny. So again, they're off the shelf. They're really cheap, they said as well. So everything starts to become a lot more manageable with regards to the price, which I thought was good too. Another small thing they mentioned too is that obviously that's the multi-rotor, the vertical takeoff aspect of the aircraft. It's also got the fixed wing, which has control surfaces as well, which work very nicely. You know, we've all talked about these throughout the course and throughout our podcasts, the ailerons and obviously the elevators, etc. But because they've got so many motors, they also say that actually if they lose a control surface like a servo, or if something breaks, some of the propellers can actually kind of help the aircraft bank or pitch as well if they turn on, and it does sense that. And so even the control surfaces have redundancy, which is again unheard of, I think, really. You know, you do get planes that can use the flaps sometimes if you're lucky, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the other thing that they talk about as well is, apart from just sort of assisting in control, the other thing that he talks about is that in effect they have two fully functional aircraft strapped together. It's not mechanically done that way, but in effect. So the fixed wing aircraft flies using the aerodynamics of the wings and the control surfaces. As Tom said, if one of those control surfaces fails, the motors can assist with the control if it remains in forward flight. But ultimately, if it has a bird strike and one of the wings is torn off, or the whole control surface is torn off and it's totally out of control, it can then transition into a hover and just vertically would maintain flight and control, perhaps to the ground or otherwise back to base if it still has enough battery left, using the power of the vertically mounted motor. So back into quadcopter mode, if we can describe it that way, or multi-rotor mode. So there's real redundancy here to cover both ways. Whichever system fails, there's a bailout system, which is absolutely incredible. I think that's revolutionary in itself.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll come back to a phrase that I took from the video actually, which kind of tells you how safe this aircraft is, and we'll have a look at that yes. in a bit actually, yes. Too. Moving on then to so obviously we've got the drone, we've got the fact that it can take off and it can fly really nicely. What about what it's supposed to do, which is, you know, carrying your coffee or your trainers to your door? The Amazon approach was obviously to make the drone quite big, which, you know, basically is what I would have probably gone with, really. You know, a big sort of fuselage which can take a certain package and off you go.
Yep.
Google Wing has done something very clever, again, I think, and it yes. uses basically a winch. Yeah. And sort of a box type of affair, hasn't yeah, it, Matthew?
Sorry to interrupt, Tom, but they're literally thinking outside of the box in this case.
Oh, that's good. I'll have to apologise to the listeners on Matthew's behalf as I'm joking. But no, exactly right. And again, something else that I hadn't thought about. If you've got a giant aircraft, you've got a lot of air resistance. And so obviously, on the way there, it's got air resistance. It then opens the door, you know, the trainers come out, it then flies back. It's still the same shape. It's still got a lot of air resistance. So what Google have done is kept the plane really tiny, and this has got two other benefits, or maybe one other benefit. It then lowers down a winch, hooks onto the box, which is the payload. It lifts the box up, and as it gets very close to the aircraft, it kind of locates itself, which I thought was smart as well. So if the box can be in any orientation, because it could spin, it's only one kind of thread that's lifting it, or one cable, I should say. And it kind of hits the fuselage, if I can say that properly, spins around and kind of locks in, and off it goes. And so the plane now takes the box along, it then winches it down, drops it off, and now when it comes back, it's effectively a very small aircraft again, because it doesn't have the box anymore, which is great for, you know, again, air resistance. And I think another benefit of that as well kind of gets rid of the whole, how is the drone going to land on the ground when it drops off its package? The answer is it doesn't. It literally hovers, you know, 20 feet up in the air, lowers down the box. So really it only needs, you know, a couple of feet clearance realistically. Although I think it searches for a good 10 meter kind of area to make sure it's safe.
I think they did say 10 meters. Yeah. I think probably on a practical level, it could be done in a smaller space, but that's a good space to have available to do it reliably. And as you'll talk about in a moment, very reliably, in fact. Just one step back as well, Tom. I found it very interesting listening to the chat about the development of the box itself. So of course, when we say a box, the box is actually really cleverly designed. It's symmetrical front to back, so it can fit into the aircraft or sort of latch onto the aircraft either way around, forwards or backwards, it's the same. And the box itself is actually very aerodynamic for a box. I mean, it's not a missile shape by any means, but it's really quite something to see. These guys have put incredible thought into it, and it seems like a relatively small team of very bright people have done this. Perhaps that's the better way forward than the NASA approach of hundreds and hundreds of people complicating things too much. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because it almost still looks and feels a bit like a hobby drone, but obviously all the background systems and everything else is, you know, industrial to, you know, the nth degree, isn't it? I think when you watch their kind of systems that they use and things. But it's great. And I just thought all of those things that I've just talked about, or we've just talked about, are things that I've never even kind of thought would be possible. And actually you're like, oh my god, I hadn't thought of that, or I hadn't thought of this. And it's so good, the fact that they've thought of these things. And obviously we've got nothing to do with this Google Wing at all, but we're just genuinely impressed about how kind of it works, and the thought they've put into it, I think, which really has shown, hasn't it? So that's basically how it can basically fly, I think, up to about 10 to 15 kilometers, they reckon. That's its range. So pretty damn good, Rid. And I think that's obviously more to do with the fact that it only has the box on board for half the flight, I think, which obviously makes a big difference. Another thing that they've done as well, which again has to be thought about, is the charging. And because they've got so many of these drones, again, if you watch the video, they've got a whole sort of, you know, sort of fleet that all can take off and land simultaneously.
I think 50, if I'm not mistaken, Tom. I think they've got sort of the test facility that on the video. I think there's 50 aircraft simultaneously ready to go.
Yeah, that's it. And they are, as we've probably mentioned, obviously autonomous as well. So obviously there's no pilot involved. There's a pilot there to take over if anything goes wrong. But obviously what then you have to think about is if these 50 drones all are going up and down and taking off and coming back, you know, is there someone running around, you know, unplugging the batteries, plugging them on the charger and coming back again? You know, that would be chaotic and dangerous. So what they've done is actually used wireless charging technology. So when the drone lands back on its landing pad, it starts to charge automatically again, which I think is great, isn't it, Matthew? It's pretty cool.
Which is phenomenal, yeah. Really is. I didn't see very clearly the sort of contact points or how accurately it needs to sit above the pad and so on. I'm not entirely clear about that. But as you say, it's just phenomenal technology. We live in an amazing time.
Yeah, and I think that the aircraft kind of decides how long to charge for depending on the next job it's got to do. So the charging times are anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes again. So yeah, pretty damn quick. And because they've got so many of them, it doesn't have to be as fast, does it, I suppose?
That's it, yeah. I think that's sort of part of their redundancy to that issue, is that they have loads of aircraft available and the system as a whole knows which aircraft are ready to go and which have just flown and are busy charging and so on. So a package would never be allocated to an aircraft that's waiting to finish charging.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I'm not 100% sure how the packages get loaded. I have a feeling that the drone kind of takes off and then there's someone bringing it out and then it hooks on and then it goes. So there is a bit of human interaction, I think.
Yes.
But again, I guess there has to be sort of at some point. But yeah, so if we now carry on and we'll start talking about kind of how they operate in the sky. And now one of the interesting things is that obviously, like I said, they are autonomous and they are aware of their surroundings, a bit like most drones, I suppose, nowadays. But interestingly, they're not actually aware of each other. So that was quite an interesting thing that they mentioned. You know, we kind of see or visualize, you know, a screen with loads of little aircraft dotting around and they're all dodging each other. But I think what happens is actually that all happens to start with. So that the route is planned, the control system then software wise knows what each one are doing, so then it can kind of, it's a bit like, I guess, these autonomous drones that do these light shows. I probably imagine they're not aware of each other, but the system controlling them knows exactly where a drone should be at each moment in time, I guess. Do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. They don't necessarily need to sense each other. There's no reason why they should, because I'm sure they have a perfectly safe system in terms of the separation between the different aircraft. And as you say, the whole thing sort of plans, one sort of plans around the other. They would never use the same flight path up and down.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's what they've done, which again makes sense, I think, doesn't it, really, which is good. And interestingly, the software that kind of then creates the sort of the waypoint journey, I suppose, for these aircraft also takes into account sort of the weather conditions as well, which is great too. So obviously the wind speed is very important. And obviously, as we know, if it's having to travel back into the wind, it will use a lot more energy than it sort of traveling with the wind. So it works out all of that as well. And like we've mentioned before as well, it does check the landing area too. So like we've mentioned, you do need a 10 meter by 10 meter kind of free area, but the drone isn't going to come in and land in that area. It's going to drop the box in that area. So realistically, I think from the videos I've also seen, it kind of stays above roof height, doesn't it? Or double your roof height and uses the winch, which is cool.
I think so. And I think also all part of their system, and we'll move on to the sort of ordering process and so on any moment now, but I think part of the system is also that as the receiver, as the client, you need to be there to receive it. It won't actually drop it on the ground, I don't think. I think you have to disconnect it from the sort of winch line, if I'm not mistaken. But I do speak under correction on that. And I think part of the relevance of tracking the time and the weather conditions and so on is so that on the app, you can see exactly when that aircraft's going to arrive outside for you to collect your parcel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of the kind of sort of the advantages, I guess, of this side of things, you know, and obviously having Google behind it means that they've actually developed a really nice app. And it, from the looks of it, looks like a really simple process. It's like going on to Amazon, I suppose, really. You know, you click, you buy something, it gives you a delivery time. And it also then tells you to kind of move the little dot to where you want it to land if there's space. So you look outside, you know, move it to your drive or move it to your garden, etc. And then it'll tell you to clear the area. So if you click go, you'll have to move all your, you know, your kids' toys out the way or reverse your car out and put it on the road or something, just so or your children as well. Yeah, exactly. And once you've done all of those kind of tick boxes, then the aircraft obviously starts its journey, which is very cool as well. So literally you open the app, order anything you like or whatever's on the app, obviously, which is available. And apparently at the moment, their most popular things are a cooked chicken, would you believe, which is very, very cool. Coffee and Tim Tam biscuits as well. So you've got a nice selection there of stuff. That's all you need, really, isn't it, Matthew? I think coffee and chicken is about right.
It certainly is a survival pack that will get me to the end of the week for sure.
Yeah.
I was just about to say, to me, I think one of the most incredible things about this whole story is we're not talking about the future, we're talking about now. Of course, it is sort of in the developmental stages in terms of mass rollout, but this is happening in multiple countries on a daily basis. This is happening, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's every minute and a half or so a delivery is happening with these drones. So that to me is absolutely incredible. It's really proof of concept, and the fact that I think there's a lot of room for expansion potentially. It could go physically larger aircraft working on similar principles and so on in future to carry larger containers and that sort of thing. But it's just mind-blowing that it is actually already happening out there.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and at the moment, they're only delivering in parts of the US, Finland and Australia at the moment. So you can't get the app now and have all this happen, unfortunately, because I'm sure we'd all just stop recording and go and try it ourselves now. But no, we can't do that, unfortunately. But another thing to sort of basically kind of conclude with, I guess, really, is the people who have designed all of this are, you know, very aviation kind of orientated. And what they're trying to do is make aviation sort of a normal everyday occurrence. And they use the example of, you know, if you say to someone, when did you last go on a plane, they'll think, maybe 6 months ago, or, you know, or maybe a couple of months ago. You know, it's quite an occasion. I still enjoy it. You know, if I'm honest, I'm still a bit of a kid when planes sort of are involved. You know, I actually look forward to the whole experience of being on an aircraft. It's still a treat for me, I would say. And what they're trying to do with this is actually make aviation something that, you know, is normal, a bit like a car journey. You know, you don't talk about that so much, about when were you last in your car, but, you know, it'll be, oh, when did you last get a drone delivery? Oh, you know, yesterday type of thing. So it's quite a funny sort of idea, I suppose, really. And finally, then, I guess the statistic that we were kind of talking about previously about why these aircraft are so safe, or how can they be so safe, they reckon that actually having a package delivered by one of their drones is actually the safest way of moving that box from A to B, which is incredible. They even mention it's safer than actually picking up the box and walking, you know, because obviously you could fall over, you could hurt yourself. So apparently this is the safest way to move a box, which is quite a good tagline, isn't it?
Yes, statistically speaking, that is incredible. I would have thought it would take years and years to get to the point where that's actually true, but they're claiming that that is the case already.
Yeah, that's it. And I think the reason behind that is because they've done lots of actual flights with these aircraft, but crucially, they've done lots of simulated flights as well. I think they said over 1 million simulated flights. So obviously, they're really getting kind of that sort of reliability down, I think, because obviously the FAA won't let this happen unless it's safe. And so obviously they've got to kind of simulate stuff. And I think that's how it'll work. You know, it's hard to have physical flights happen that quickly, whereas a computer base can simulate things very quickly, can't it? And kind of work out where the problems could be, I guess, before they happen, which is good.
Yeah, that's right. Looking at it from outside, it's a really sort of exciting and fun thing to chat about, and the aircraft look pretty cool and so on. But I think at the heart of it, there's some serious engineering and some serious developmental work that's gone on to get to this point. I think the guys take it very seriously. And of course, they've got a big budget backing them as well. So this hasn't happened overnight. It's been a long path for them to take to get to where they are. It looks simple at the end because they've solved all of the problems that they encounter along the way, but it really is something incredible, well worth a watch of the video, as you said at the beginning.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you know, I'm really happy this is actually happening, because I was a bit disappointed with Amazon and thought, oh, you know, that's a shame, that would have been quite a cool thing. But I'm glad that our company is still doing it, and hopefully you know, we might see it in the UK at some point, I suppose, depending on how nice the CAA are, I suppose, really, as well. So that's kind of the first part of the podcast then. Hopefully you found that very interesting. Like I say, and like Matthew mentioned, go and watch the video, and hopefully now it'll all come alive a bit more as well. But next part then, or the final part of the podcast then, is actually talking about our drone predictions, or future drones. So it's kind of split up into two bits, I suppose. So we're going to be having a look, or thinking about what we think the drone industry is going to kind of move towards. And then finally, we're going to have a quick chat about our perfect drone. So if we had all the money, all the technology, and kind of no limits, what would we do? What would we do? You know, me and Matthew's prime drone that you'd all go out and buy. Yeah. what would we design? So we'll talk about that to sort of finish off as well. So what I'll do is actually hand this section a little bit more over to Matthew, and he can sort of chat us through, and we can both talk about what we think is going to happen to the drone industry within, I don't know, the next sort of 2 or 3 years. So Matthew, what do you reckon?
Tabia, I think this is very interesting. I think we'll first start by looking at sort of likely developments based on experience of having seen the developments and what the manufacturers have done and how they've responded to the sort of growth of the industry and so on over time. So what I think is foreseeable is, of course, further developments along the lines that they're already doing. So I think it's very likely that the focus will go to designing and producing more capable, small, lightweight aircraft. I think that's the trend that we're likely to see moving forward. So we've just seen the launch of the Mavic 3, phenomenal specifications, which were unheard of and we couldn't have dreamt of a couple of years ago. So that's an example of the sort of development we're talking about. I think it's going to go further still. I think, you know, with all technology, it's very difficult to foresee the future, but it's just likely that the resolution will get higher, the range will get better, the flight time will get longer. All of the factors we look for will continue to improve. The other thing that I think is likely to happen is more autonomy as well. So at this stage, interestingly, that's different to what the regulators seem to be guiding us towards. They're trying to keep sort of manual control and so on as a really sort of primal part of drone flying and drone operations. But I have a feeling that more and more autonomy makes sense, because I think an interesting line is that computers don't make mistakes, they process human errors correctly. So the pilot is often the weakest link when accidents happen. And I think the more autonomy there is, the safer the technology becomes, and safety is paramount. So yeah, more autonomy must be in line. What do you think about that, Tom?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's definitely true. And as we mentioned with the Mavic 3, you know, the camera systems are becoming as important actually as the main camera on the drone. You know, you wouldn't have thought that actually, you know, 5 years ago that, you know, you'd have more than maybe two cameras on the drone, but now we've got, you know, 10 or so. So it is pretty incredible. And going back to kind of my experiences with sort of wind turbine surveying. So a couple of years ago, we did quite a big contract with EDF doing wind turbine surveying, and the drone itself was actually a self-built kind of autonomous aircraft. And the way it flew around the wind turbine within about 3 meters of the blade, I couldn't do that. There was no chance in hell I'd be able to actually get that precision, especially when it went behind and when it went, you know, up. The optical illusions that you could see when you think the drone would move around, and when it went right to the top of the wind turbine, it would come quickly down, and I would be like, oh god, it's going to hit something. But no, it wouldn't do, because it had that vision. And you know, from probably about the 600-700 flights I did, I only had to take over twice. So you know, the aircraft was pretty clever, and the only reason I kind of had to take over was, one, the wind turbine started to turn, or that the brakes stopped, so the wind turbine started moving. Obviously the drone didn't know what to do then. And another time I think something else happened as well. So no, autonomous drones are very reliable actually, and like you say, they get rid of the pilot out of the equation, which sometimes is or most of the time the weak link. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's certainly very relevant. Your story tells the story of the future, I think, in a sense. I think that'll become more and more mainstream and more accessible to sort of standard off-the-shelf drones as well. I think sort of alongside that, obstacle avoidance must improve. We've seen a relatively big step forward, I think, in the Mavic 3 from the previous generation. That's likely to just continue happening. I think the more data they can process and more sensors they can put on board, the more aware of its environment the drone becomes, and it's just likely that they'll keep adding more and more, because they'll make the components smaller and higher resolution, and they can just put more of them on without any weight penalty and so on. So yeah, I think that's certainly a secondary thing that'll happen. And then also collision avoidance as well, I think, sort of and awareness of other drones potentially as well, because I think in the foreseeable future, we're likely to see them integrate into the air traffic control systems of manned aircraft as well, so that we're aware of them and they're aware of us and so on. And it makes perfect sense that if they all have beacons in them and sensors in them and so on to know about manned aircraft, they may as well know about each other. So I think it's likely that that sort of interaction between drones is very likely to improve, or to sort of go the next step in foreseeable future, generations of aircraft as well. Tom, you actually added the point of less compatibility to our notes. Give us a bit more on that. What are you thinking along those lines? What did you have in mind when you said that?
Yeah, so I guess it's kind of already happened, to be honest, I suppose. It's a little bit like what we were talking about with the Mavic 3. So obviously back when we used to build our own drones, you know, you'd spec them to a certain specification of battery, and you could buy any number of those batteries. You could change the size, you could maybe up the voltage, as long as the battery fitted in the aircraft and the Velcro strap went around correctly, then the chances are you'd probably be fine. And obviously now we've seen, especially with the DJI aircraft, and I can totally understand why it's happening, because again, these drones are so tiny, they're quite specific, and so the battery now needs to kind of almost be specific. And also with the default or the sort of the off-the-shelf batteries that you could purchase, there was a lot of chance that the user could buy the wrong battery, they could have the wrong connector, you know, and just plug in something. Yeah, and the charging was a whole nother problem, which people, unless you really wanted to understand, it was a difficult thing. You could quite easily, you know, I with my high powered charger that I used to have, you know, you could quite easily dial in the wrong settings and essentially, you know, blow the battery up. You could do that if you really wanted to. It wouldn't stop you. So
yeah, the
way behind that is to obviously make that impossible. And obviously then you have a bespoke battery which only fits that aircraft. You can't get it in the wrong way. You can't put it in and not click it in properly and stuff like that. And obviously the charger, you can't adjust the charging curve. It literally gives exactly what the battery needs, and you just know when it starts and when it stops. And it sounds a bit restrictive, but actually it's kind of nice sometimes just to take that guesswork out of things, and actually it looks after itself and you don't need to worry too much. So I think there's, you know, two ways of looking at things, I suppose, but it could be a downside, couldn't it, as well?
It is actually another sort of interesting point on that is that drone technology is actually one of few technologies where we still see any sort of remaining element of that. If you think about it, if we look at vehicles, if we look at computers, if we look at normal cameras, there's very, very little compatibility between anything. I mean, I suppose you can buy similar tires for different vehicles, but that's about as far as it goes. Certainly very little in the way of any kind of components or anything. So I think probably it's just because the technology is relatively new, and new enough that we still remember the sort of grassroots and how the development started, that we're even aware of that. Outside of that, any other technology, you wouldn't expect one laptop's battery to fit into the next. So yeah, no, I think you're probably right. I think it has happened, and I don't think we'll be going back anytime soon with regard to that. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's it. And obviously we've got the kind of last thing to talk about again is the kind of the certification. I suppose that's what we're kind of pushing towards, isn't it, really? So again, I'm not sure what else to say on that note. We don't have any more information, do we? And we know it's coming. Anything else, Matthew?
We don't have any more information. I think just one little bit of so probably a guess as much as anything is, I wonder whether there's a manufacturer out there waiting in the wings to launch something to sort of leapfrog some of the other bigger manufacturers and try to satisfy the demand for certified aircraft. I mean, I think it must be possible. I don't think you need to be one of the biggest manufacturers in the world to go through the process. So perhaps one of the smaller manufacturers, maybe that we know, or maybe somebody new, will launch something and come into the market with the first C2 certified aircraft, for example. That's possible. Maybe it'll drive the industry forward as well, the certification process.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think it would be quite an eye-opener if that suddenly happened, wouldn't it, I think, really, which would be quite fun as well. So, yeah, I think, and obviously all of this will start to happen, well, within the next sort of couple of years, really, won't it, I should think, really. So, obviously, we hope the certification happens a little bit sooner than that, but, we're not 100% sure. So that's kind of where the industry is going from our point of view, and I would say hopefully that's fairly accurate, but I guess we'll find out in the not-too-distant
time
future.
Time will tell,
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So cool. OK, so just to finish off then, we've got our last point to talk about here, which is if me and Matthew suddenly went into business, you know, we've got a huge inheritance and we decided, right, we're going to go into the drone business with all of our knowledge. What would we do? What would we design? And, you know, kind of what are the features? So we'll kind of share this. I think we'll have a little chat between the two of us. But Matthew, if you want to sort of kick us off with a few ideas, what do you reckon then?
Yeah, Tom, I think just to sort of clarify the scope of what we're talking about, I think some of what we're going to say seems unrealistic with current technology. We're going to be talking about things that at this point in time aren't possible, that are a dream, but certainly would be something that we'd love to have. So let's start at the top. We're looking at quite a radically different drone in my mind. So first of all, what I think would be really nice to have, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, is a more modular design, something which would allow repair of aircraft. So if you damaged a motor, you wouldn't be sort of unscrewing the motor necessarily, but you could remove the arm from the drone, for example. And sort of, so more modular design would be something I would choose to have if I could. And I think that would also potentially open up the scope for sort of hardware upgrades and payload options. So you could fit different cameras, different gimbals, different sensors, and so on, and have a bit more interchangeability between the aircraft. I would love to have that, but I don't think it's something that we're going to see anytime soon. So sort of, as you said, this is a bit of a dream. More rugged construction, I think, would be a really positive thing, because I think we have to handle these modern drones so carefully at all times, and the smallest incident often renders them unflyable or damaged and needing to be sent off for repair. If they were built a little bit stronger, that would seem like a good idea. But I do appreciate the fact that stronger tends to be heavier, which is going to take away flight time and all the other benefits we'd like. But yeah, that would be nice if we could have it. Another concept which I thought of, and I think, Tom, this one may potentially happen in the foreseeable future, but in a few different ways possibly, is just a concept that I thought about would be some kind of an illuminated skin that you would be able to sort of dial up and down the amount of illumination. So in effect, the whole aircraft could glow so that you were able to see it at distance in low light and so on. And one way that I thought that that could potentially be done without sort of thinking along the lines of a sci-fi film would be illuminating a semi-translucent structure. So sort of bright LED systems inside. That's something that I think could happen. But yeah, sort of a more alien-like skin that illuminated and changed colors would be far better. But that's probably going a little bit far off the tracks.
So what do you think? Maybe go red, couldn't it, when the battery was running out or something, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And potentially it could sort of be, give you some orientation. It could be red at the back and blue at the front, or green and red, or whatever. You could maybe sort of dial that into your preference and make the aircraft easier to see. Because I think that's something that a lot of these modern aircraft lack, is they've got some LEDs on the corners, but the frame itself, the aircraft itself, is really difficult to see, in fact.
Yeah.
Particularly in low light.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, we've got a couple more concepts to talk about. We've got something that I thought about is a sort of hybrid design for all conditions, which seamlessly sort of morphs between the two. And when I say morph, I don't necessarily mean it transforms its shape, but it's, let's say it's in quadcopter mode, for lack of a better description. You're flying around, you're hovering, you're doing some shots, you start to accelerate away, you're following a vehicle at a certain speed, the aircraft automatically could sort of transform into a more fixed wing configuration and start using the aerodynamics of the aircraft to carry its weight and so on. But I would love and dream of having that, a sort of seamless transition. So I'm focusing on the shot, I'm focusing on just where I'm moving this aircraft to, and it is carrying itself and so, and working all that out itself. So I think that's quite a cool concept. What do you think of that, Tom?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a great idea. And I suppose making something that could happen maybe sooner rather than later, something I thought of was the fact that obviously all these drones are very small now, which is great, but it is harder to get flight time out of a smaller aircraft. So potentially maybe the booms could extend and then you could put larger propellers on or something. I don't know. You know, that could potentially be something. I know the motors might have to change and then the battery might have to change, so it could be difficult. But then at least you've got the option then of having a larger aircraft, which could kind of, you know, sort of transform a bit, like you say, as well. So maybe somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, perhaps we could take a lesson from our previous chat. As the booms extend, the extra motors are there. You just got to drop on the extra props. the next set of motors extend out. There we go.
That would be cool, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the other thing that would be highly desirable is if we could make them quieter still. I do think that that's asking a lot, because these modern aircraft are incredibly good. If we look at just Mavic 2s, they were a big leap forward in the sort of sound levels. So I think it's unlikely that that's possible, but if we could do it, make them quieter still. I thought about the idea of something like sort of relatively large ducted propellers or ducted fans running lower RPM than conventional sort of ducted fans, because that would also house the props, make them safe, make the aircraft sort of more easily handleable in flight, or sort of less dangerous in flight. So I think there's sort of something to be thought about rather than just the good old standard brushless motor and propeller, just a different propulsion system which is quieter, more efficient, etc. And then the final thing which I thought about, and I wouldn't say this is too unimaginable, although I don't know if any of the manufacturers would actually think about doing it at this point, is a protection system which would both protect the drone and anybody around in the form of something along the lines of an airbag type system. Now, I'm not talking about a heavyweight thing like you find in the steering wheel of your car, but possibly, in effect, for lack of a better description, a sort of instant beach ball that pops out around the drone to protect it. So break the motors to a stop, pop this out, and it could then sort of bounce to a safe area and come down to the ground. Sort of, I don't know, deflatable ball that pops out around it would be incredible. I think that would be a fantastic risk mitigation for people looking for low separation distances and so on. If you had an automated system that could do that and render the drone, in effect, pretty much harmless, that would be phenomenal, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think they're kind of starting to do that with, I know they, I've seen that type of thing on sort of motorcycle jackets and you know, helmets for motorbikes as well. If you if it senses you falling off, it pops this great big thing around you and kind of protects you. So something similar like that, but just maybe condensed down for a drone, could be very cool, couldn't it, actually? So I hope DJI are listening to this. You know, we're giving away all of our our top secrets here. So moving on to other things then. So obviously to do with flight time and stuff, you know, I keep thinking that we need longer flight time, but I don't know if we do, to be honest. You know, it's so long now that actually I don't know, but let's pretend we do. Let's say we want an hour or more, so we could hopefully work that in with different battery technology. Something else obviously then that is still a problem, I would say, and that's the charging time. So I think what might happen in the future and what we could implement actually is a little bit of the technology from electric cars. So obviously, you know, they can charge you know, much quicker than just an hour with certain manufacturers and certain sort of technologies. And I think the biggest hurdle, I think, for fast charging is the battery temperature. So potentially at home or on site, you could have this kind of hub that was, I don't know, water cooled or something, and so when you plug the battery in, it would start to cool the battery down. It could then charge within, you know, 15 minutes or something instead, and then you'd be back up again. So I think if they started to implement some of the ideas from the electric car side of things, then, you know, we might get quicker charging, mightn't we? So we've already got batteries that heat themselves, so why not have them cool themselves as well, I guess? You know, never know, do you?
Yeah, that's right. I agree with you. I think charging time is a crucial thing. Exactly as you'd said, we haven't even spoken about this before, but exactly as you've said, I think we've got loads of flight time. We've got as much as our concentration can handle, as much as most commercial operations require. We now want to be able to, as you say, zap them up to full power again very, very quickly. That'll be a huge leap in technology. And I think that'll happen in future for sure. How they'll do it, I don't know, but it's very likely to happen for sure. The other thing which I thought about, Tom, which I think would have its place, and as we said in the beginning, we're dreaming about ultimate possibility, is being able to have very high quality image quality in a 360 cam on the aircraft. So of course, potentially that could be done with multiple cameras and sort of software seamlessly joining them and so on. I think that would be really cool for certain aspects of drone flying and imagery and so on. I think it's perhaps not everybody's requirement, but it would just be ultra cool to have that available. You can basically just fly the aircraft through any space and then in post use whichever bit you want. And I think you could do some incredible editing and come up with some unseen shots, which would be phenomenal for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think that's a great idea as well. Then you don't necessarily need, if I'm correct, a gimbal then necessarily, because I think it can all be kind of post-processed within the image itself, I think, which is quite handy too. So that's interesting. Obviously, another thing that we could mention as well is maybe a bit more weather resistance. Again, you know, there's some scope there to stop raindrops hitting the lens and stuff like that, which would mean then, because I'm sure they can make drones that are waterproof, it's probably not overly difficult. But obviously, there's still the gimbal and the lens issue. So I guess there must be something that we could come up with, Matthew, there to sort that out?
Yeah, for sure. I think, again, we need a blast of air moving out over the lens, pointing outwards from an onboard ducted fan again, something like that. But yeah, I think that the water resistance is something that I'm surprised none of the big manufacturers have focused on, because in our climate, it's so frustrating that just the tiny amount of rain, and which is otherwise perfectly flyable, and you could be doing data collection, not necessarily photography, but you could be doing other data collection with thermal and so on, and instantly you're grounded by that. So I'm actually surprised, as you say, I think it's quite possible already that they could be doing it. I don't know why they haven't done that, but yeah, having a waterproof, let's say waterproof, water resistant aircraft would be a big advantage, I think, for sure.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and finally, then a bit more about the sort of the control and kind of the data link, I suppose. Really, I reckon that what we'll do is come up with some sort of augmented reality. So we've obviously got VLOS of the drone all the time, but we've also got, you know, maybe our special glasses or something instead that kind of projects the image onto sort of our retinas. Let's go really, really futuristic, sorry, and have that. And so then you've got the best of both worlds. And I know there are things that kind of semi-exist that give you that, but we're talking about very much feeling inside the aircraft, I suppose, really, and feeling as though we've got all the information we need, but also we can sense the area and the stuff around us as well, I think.
Yeah,
too.
I agree with you, Tom. I think being able to seamlessly switch between the two, so if you could sort of have the FPV view so that you can see the shot that you're getting, but at the same time, intuitively using, I don't know, pressure on the thumbsticks of your controller or something like that, be able to switch to just being able to look directly at the aircraft and see where it is and see its orientation and so on. Just making that easier to do. I know there are some FPV glasses which have obviously the FPV, I said glasses, sorry, I meant goggles, FPV goggles where you can see the FPV cam, and then if you just touch the side of the goggles, it switches to a cam which is mounted on the front of the goggles pointing outwards, and people use that for sort of walking from their car to the takeoff and landing point because you're not sort of having to shift the goggles up and down. So I think that's sort of the first step in that direction, but the dream world would be to have a far better view than that and sort of physically be able to see, but at the same time see all the telemetry and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and I think that'll be coming soon anyway, really, with all the virtual reality headsets and stuff. You know, I've got the Oculus, the Quest 2, and that has the same thing. If you move out too far in your room, the four cameras turn on and you can see your surroundings. It's not great, but in the next one, I think it'll be almost like you can see normally with these cameras, which will be quite cool as well. So, yeah, I think that'll happen too, won't it? And then to sort of finish off, I suppose, really, maybe better ways of transferring data and stuff like that. I guess we could have, obviously, with the fact that 5G is sort of becoming more kind of prevalent around the place, you know, maybe as the drone's filming, it's directly streaming to your laptop or to the cloud or whatever you want, actually. So there's no SD card faffiness and bits and pieces like that, I suppose. In an ideal world, it's already in your client's computer before you've even landed or something. You know, I guess that would be the ideal situation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I think along the same lines and using the similar technology would be having the sort of updates and firmware updates for the aircraft itself happen in the touch of a button really quickly, really efficiently, with no hassle. Because I think historically, that's the one thing that I've always found frustrating through all the generations of aircraft. In fact, I had an example of it today where somebody did their flight test this morning. He'd updated the drone recently. When he put it on the landing pad, he turned it on and it was telling him it needed an update. Fortunately, it was actually only the battery. And I think we've probably all experienced that where you've got four batteries, you update it with one of the batteries in it and the other three also need to update in their own time. So those little frustrating hitches, if that could happen in seconds and sort of just sort itself out, that would be pure bliss for me at certain times. Yeah, it's been very frustrating in the past.
Yeah, or even if the drone could sort of sit in a standby mode or something. So if the battery's plugged in, it doesn't fully switch off. It can kind of sit there in the background, and if there is a firmware update, it kind of does that in your bag or at home while you're charging or something, I guess, too, something like that. But I guess that's probably more possible than maybe some of the things we've been talking about, hey, Matthew? Yeah, that's great. So I think we've almost created the perfect drone, I imagine. So we better get on saving up and designing it, and I'm sure we'll have a few customers. What do you reckon?
Well, I don't know. Maybe our ideas are different. It'll be interesting to get some feedback from people and see what their ideas are, what their dream machine is, what features we haven't thought of that they'd be keen to have.
Yeah, That's true. Brilliant. So I think that takes us to the end of this episode. So thank you very much, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to go and watch that Google Wing video because it really is interesting, I think. And I guess the final things to say are just like normal that we talk about, really. So making sure that you obviously subscribe to the podcast. Give us a review if you haven't already. And also be sure to share it to people that maybe aren't listening as well, any sort of drone friends that you've got, etc. As well. So thank you very much for listening. Thanks, Matthew. Thank you for chatting with me. It's been great. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've done for sure.
Great, brilliant. Okay, and we'll see you all back next week, hopefully with Adam on board as well. Take care and fly safe, and we'll speak to you soon. Thanks a lot.